loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, President Donald Trump said yesterday that Defense Secretary James Mattis, quote, knocked the hell, close quote, out of ISIS because he, the president, and his policies had made it possible. Is Trump already trying to rewrite history? Then we are joined from Boston by noted historian and author Alfred McCoy to discuss his latest book, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power.
But first, we turn to ISIS. We are joined by Ali Mousawi. He is a war correspondent covering the war against Daesh, or ISIS, in Iraq. And we are also joined from Cairo by Joe Loria. He is a journalist and political commentator and author of How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Thanks for having me.
So yesterday, Donald Trump, in a meeting with Defense Secretary James Mattis that was broadcast on U.S. and international networks, congratulated Mattis for, quote, knocking the hell out of ISIS. And he said that ISIS was defeated because Donald Trump and his policies made it possible. Is Trump already rewriting this history? Let's go to Ali.
Well, it's kind of funny how he's trying to take so much credit for the defeats of ISIS in both Iraq and Syria. The U.S. did play a part, especially on the Iraqi side, as well as the American-backed Syrian Democratic Forces. But they were not the main players to defeat ISIS in those two countries. The credit has to solely goes to the Iraqi forces and the Syrian forces, the Syrian Arab Army, as well as the Iraqi Army. They led the war against ISIS, and they were the one who took the main, basically they were at the main front lines. They took all the strategic areas from the terrorists, and they were the one who sacrificed the most to defeat ISIS in both countries. I'm not sure where Trump is coming up with this, where he's congratulating himself for a move that was actually set up by the last president, Barack Obama. He basically just continued the same policies that Obama started against ISIS with the U.S.-led anti-ISIS coalition, and just continued doing the same thing, only with a bit more aggressive than Obama did. And that was all that Trump really did against ISIS over the past year of his tenure.
Right. Joe Loria, when my colleagues and I were watching this Trump statement here in the studio, we were surprised, frankly. We try not to be surprised by anything that Donald Trump says, but this seemed to come out of left field. And certainly I don't know any Americans who believe it to be true. What was the reaction in the Middle East?
Well, I could say that, first of all, we have to separate the Syrian and the Iraqi campaigns against ISIS. There are two totally different wars, in my opinion. And you have to go back, as Ali said, to the Obama administration as well. I think that Trump can try to get away with this because there's been a lot of news about ISIS from the very beginning that's been suppressed in corporate media. For example, this Defense Intelligence Agency document of August 2012 that showed the U.S., Turkey, the Gulf Arabs, and some European countries were helping establish a Salafist principality in eastern Syria that could threaten Assad and that could turn into Islamic State. Use those actual words, and that's exactly what happened there. Then there was the myth, really, that Russia had nothing to do with this, that Russia was not really fighting ISIS. It was only the U.S. was, that Russia was fighting moderate rebels trying to overthrow Assad. Well, we know that that's rubbish, and we know it is because John Kerry himself, as Secretary of State, in a leaked audio conversation in September of 2016, was heard saying that the reason, I'm quoting, the reason Russia came in is because ISIL was getting stronger. Daesh was threatening the possibility of going to Damascus, and that's why Russia came in. If they didn't want a Daesh government, and they supported Assad. He's admitting there that Russia came in to fight ISIS. And then he says, he admits here, Kerry, that the U.S. was never fighting Daesh in Syria. Seriously, never. He says, quote, we know that this was growing. We were watching. We saw that Daesh was growing in strength, and we thought that Assad was threatened. We thought, however, we could probably manage that Assad then might negotiate. Instead of negotiating, he got Putin to support him. So the U.S., as that document in 2012 said, was supporting this group to put pressure on Assad. And a couple of years later, 4 years later, here's Kerry admitting that the U.S. was not fighting Daesh in Syria. They were using it to try to put Assad out of power. That risk, the jihadists taking over in Damascus. I don't know if the plan was, once Assad left, if he did, that they would then go to war against Daesh in Syria, but that never happened. Now, in Iraq, it was a different war because the U.S. had a big political stake in that. They paid a big cost politically from the 2003 invasion, the absolute disaster that was. They could not allow ISIS to take any more territory in Iraq, let alone threaten Baghdad. So they fought a very fierce war there right from the time Erbil was threatened in the summer of 2014. And that's when Obama announced to the world who ISIS was, and he began the bombing campaign then. And then, of course, they completely destroyed that city to destroy it, as they did Raqqa in Syria.
Okay, Joe Loria, John Kiriakou is right. There are actually two wars. They're very separate wars, really separate wars. In the case of Barack Obama and the U.S. government finally paying attention to ISIS, it's because ISIS sort of in a lightning raid was able to seize not only Mosul in the north of Iraq, but many other places, including Ramadi and other areas.
Yeah, most of the west of the country.
Yeah, and very close to Baghdad. And I think as long as ISIS was in Syria, along with Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra Front, and the other armed organizations trying to topple the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad, no big deal. But once the ISIS seized these parts of Iraq, including, it looked like it could even make a charge for Baghdad, the U.S. considered its strategic assets in Iraq to be under threat.
Right.
And that would include Erbil, that would include the North, that would include Baghdad, of course. And then Obama sort of embraced George W. Bush's call for endless war. And he said it would be an endless war because obviously the United States, after having done all that it did in Iraq, could not possibly allow all of its assets to be challenged by ISIS. I mean, it was kind of a cold-blooded determination where as long as it was in Syria, no big deal.
Right. I think that's right, Brian. And another thing, too, that the president either is deliberately ignoring or is just pretending is not an issue, is the fact that the Russians, the Iranians, the Kurds, there were a lot of different countries that or peoples that that were instrumental in keeping Daesh or ISIS at bay. So to say that this was the brilliance of American policy and American strategy is disingenuous at the very least, and it's just foolish at best.
Yeah, and I want to go back to Ali, who's been covering the war in Iraq, because and ask you, Ali, if you agree with this, that there are really two different wars. It seems to me also in the case of Syria, what actually turned the tide in Syria was Russia's decisive intervention militarily. Russia said they considered the Syrian Arab Army and the Syrian national government to be indispensable to the defeat of the terrorists in Syria. Iran was there. Hezbollah fighters were there, of course. But Russia came in, and that seemed to be the end of the prospect for the overthrow of the Assad government by armed fighters who were getting support either from the United States or from United States allies like Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia. And thus, step by step, the Syrian Arab Army and its allies on the ground were able to liberate East Aleppo, liberate, of course, Deir ez-Zor. Finally, Raqqa itself fell. Two different wars. How do you see it, Ali?
Well, he's definitely right. Those wars against, whether you call them wars against Daesh or different wars. I mean, they've been called civil wars and so on. There are definitely different wars. I mean, we have seen how whenever the Syrian army, I mean, look just at the mainstream media, how they reported both wars. You mentioned East Aleppo. as well as Mosul. Both of them were, their liberation started around the same time. Whenever the Russians were attacking, let's not forget that most of East Aleppo, Al-Qaeda, which is al-Nusra Front, was there. While in Mosul, it was Daesh or ISIL. So whenever the Russian or the Syrian Air Force attacked al-Nusra Front positions, the media reported as attacks against civilians. While in Mosul, we never heard one single report from the mainstream media when the U.S. attacked any kind of position in Mosul. I was there. There was only one incident when there was an attack by the U.S. against a hospital early on in the operation on the eastern side of Mosul, where they reported the attack was against civilian, and later it turned out to be an attack against the Iraqi army. It was accidental. Apparently, that's what it was in the end. That was the only thing that was reported against the offensive in Mosul. While in Syria, whenever there's an offensive by the Syrian army and its allies, whether it's the Russians, Hezbollah, or the Iranians, you've seen that the media reported it as attack against civilians and killing civilians and massacres and so on were reported. But in Mosul, no such thing happened. So clearly, yeah, the wars in both Syria and Iraq were definitely different. When the U.S. attacks outside in Iraq or even in Raqqa, the mainstream media did not report it as such, as attack against civilians. They said that this is attack against ISIS and that has to be done. But whenever the Syrian army or let's not forget that the Syrian government from the beginning of the war in Syria, they have mentioned that there have been militants, there have been extremists running across the country. And eventually we found out from the creation of Daesh, ISIL in both Syria and Iraq, that was the case, that militants, extremist militants were being armed, they're being sent to Syria, and later on they took over parts of Iraq. So those two have been separate wars in the media, but on the ground, from what we have seen from both the Syrian and the Iraqi sides, is that they are fighting war against extremist militants, and they both seem to have viewed the war in the same let's just say from the same lens. And that's what has allowed both the Syrian side and the Iraqi side to manage and defeat the extremists so far in both countries.
You're listening to Loud and Clear. We are broadcasting from Washington, D.C., where you can hear us on 105.5 FM and now on 1390 AM. And we are joined this morning, or this afternoon, by Ali Mousawi, who is a war correspondent covering the war against Daesh in Iraq. And we're also joined from Cairo by Joe Loria. He is a journalist and political commentator, and he is the author of How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. Brian Becker, I'm wondering if the White House is trying to make some kind of ham-handed effort to rewrite history here. I wonder if, does Donald Trump know that he sounds ridiculous when he says things like this? Or does he really believe that he won this war?
Yeah, we don't know. It's really hard to know. I mean, people were laughing. People in the room were laughing when he's sitting next to Mattis, and he pats him on the head, basically, and says, because of you, you knocked the hell out of ISIS in Syria and Iraq.
And Mattis looked embarrassed.
And then he says, well, it wasn't really you. It was me.
Right.
It was me, Donald Trump. I gave you the ability to go get him. Then he said, Trump said the U.S. must be ever vigilant against ISIS. That's not his quote because that's too articulate.
Right.
Then he said, they go all over the place. And I tell you where we don't want them. We don't want them here. We don't want them in our country. I mean, these are disconnected thoughts. Then he said, tell them to stay wherever the hell they are. We don't want them coming back into our country. They do go back into some countries. We don't want them going into our country, so we're watching them closely. I mean, Joe Loria, I mean, that's the actual president of the United States talking.
Did he really say that it was me, not you?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
He said it's me.
We actually laughed out loud while we were watching it.
Well, not tell you everything you need to know. The guy is completely focused on himself. He's a well-known narcissist, so he didn't say that. But to be somewhat fair, it is true that the U.S., with their Kurdish and some Arab allies, took Raqqa in Syria. That's it, really. The only thing that was left when the Trump administration came in terms of Syria, ISIS strongholds in Syria, was Raqqa and Deir al-Zor. And the Syrian army, Arab army, where the Russian allies took Deir al-Zor, but the Americans did take Raqqa. They destroyed a good part of that city.
Yeah, they did. A lot of that city was destroyed. And also, Joe, just real quick, I want to just ask you, if the United States had not, in alliance with the YPG or the Syrian Democratic Forces, as they are called, if they had not gone after Raqqa, I mean, it was just a matter of time before the Syrian Arab Army and its allies would have taken Raqqa. In other words, there was a race to take Raqqa, so the U.S., it seems to me, would have some place in a post-war Syria.
Yeah. Okay. There's a parallel here between what's happened in Syria and the Second World War, because there the United States says that they won the war, ignoring Russia's enormous contribution, destroying most of the Nazi army, and then there was the race for Germany. So this happened as well. The Russians, again, with the Syrian Arab army and Hezbollah and Iraqi and Shia militias, etc., defeated Daesh in Syria. The United States came in at the end, like they did in the Second World War, basically, and plant the flag in Raqqa and say they won. I think this is what Trump's doing. But people in the United States don't have the background. The media has not reported this accurately. They have not shown the actual role of the Russians and Hezbollah. They can never give credit to somebody like Hezbollah for defeating an enemy of the United States.
Sure.
They can't because Hezbollah is identified in the U.S. government and by the U.S. government as a terrorist organization. So they absolutely can't do that. Although the YPG is in alliance. The YPG is the Kurdish groups in Syria who are fighting alongside the United States, and they're politically aligned with the Turkish PKK, the Workers' Party of Korea of Turkey, which is identified as a terrorist group too. But that doesn't stop the U.S. from working with the YPG in Syria. I mean, these are all, in essence, political labels. But I agree with Joe. The U.S. can't say, "Hey, Hezbollah did a great job in helping clear Syria from terrorist organizations." Ali, go ahead if you would.
Well, of course they can't say that. I mean, one of the main reasons that there was support for militants such as Al-Qaeda, which later created Daesh or ISIL, was to destroy the influence that Iran has been given in the region. And this is also thanks to the blunders of the U.S. in the region itself after they invaded Iraq and destroyed any kind of infrastructure there is to build a country and then left it for dead in 2011. And obviously we saw that Daesh came in, and following Daesh's presence, we have the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces, which is mainly from the Shia population, and most of those groups are allied with Iran. What the U.S. Needed is to destroy, to weaken Iran in the region, and that's why Syria was attacked later on in 2011 by a huge influx of militants from across the world to, as they have called it, a civil war or a revolution or whatever it was called in the media. But once again, it's another U.S. blunder has given more influence to the U.S. and rivals or enemies in the region. Russia has more influence in the region than it ever had before. And we also have seen Iran's influence growing in Iraq, in Syria, as well as through Hezbollah in Lebanon. So while they will not admit that it was thanks to Hezbollah and Russia for the defeat of Daesh in most of these countries, let's not forget that when Russia first got involved in the war against Daesh in Syria, one of the first things they attacked are the convoys of oil leaving Syria, which was financing Daesh in Iraq and Syria. So that was one of the destroyed one of the main source of income. Something the U.S. aircraft seems to miss for some reason over the past years in Iraq and Syria.
Brian, Ali Mousavi is correct, of course. He's correct about these oil shipments, but he's correct too in the broader picture, which is that a failure of American policy in the Middle East has led us to the situation where we find ourselves now. Why is it that there is now an ISIS presence in Libya or in Afghanistan or in the Sinai Peninsula or in India, of all places? There's now an ISIS presence in the Philippines. This is all a result of the failure of U.S. policy. We just can't force our will on people without their contribution, without their rights to choose a government and expect everybody to be happy with it.
Yeah, I want to respond and then throw that same question back to Joe Loria in Cairo. First of all, there's two parts of these blunders. One is, as you're saying, John, the rise of ISIS all over the Middle East, it did not exist as an entity before the U.S. invasion, the shock and awe invasion of Iraq in March 19, 2003. There was no ISIS. There wasn't. In all the countries you just mentioned, ISIL didn't exist because ISIL didn't exist at all. So one, that's true. Secondly, in terms of Iran, the United States has identified the government of Iran since the 1979 revolution that overthrew the Shah of Iran, the monarch who was put on the throne in 1953 as a consequence of a U.S., a British coup d'etat, overthrowing a democratically elected government that had dared to nationalize the Anglo-Iranian oil company, now known as BP. So the U.S. said, well, Iran now is our enemy after they overthrew the U.S. puppet king. But here you have the United States taking out the other regional power, that would be Saddam Hussein's Iraq, that counterbalanced the influence of Iran in the region and within and inside Iraq. I remember I was in at a UN meeting at a General Assembly, outside the General Assembly, one of those September sort of sideline meetings with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was then the president of Iran. I was speaking at it as someone from the U.S. anti-war movement. Ahmadinejad got up and said, well, you know, when George W. Bush carried out the invasion of Iraq, we thought, that's a good idea. That's what he actually said at the meeting. He said, because, of course, it took out the Iraqi Saddam Ba'athist government, which treated Iran as the sort of existential enemy of the Iraqis and had gone to war with Iran. And as a consequence, having defeated Saddam after 3 weeks, there was this huge vacuum in Iraq. Well, who's likely to fill that? Of course, that gave Iran an opportunity. So, in other words, a whole series of connected and interconnected blunders. Joe Loria, when you think about it, of course, the U.S. is a, quote, great empire, meaning it has a strong military. But from the point of view of political calculations, it seems to me that this wasn't just some giant conspiracy to get from where they were in 2003 to where we are now. These are just a series of terrible mistakes within the sort of broad outlines of hubris and arrogance.
Yeah, this policy in the Middle East is founded on deep ignorance and is bringing either intentional or unintentional chaos to the region. There's a couple of motives here. One, U.S., I mean, for a long time, does not want any independent power standing up to them in the world. And Saddam had been that after he worked with them against Iran in the 1980 war. Then there's money to be made by the contractors without any question. But there may have been resources involved like oil. So, but also the aim is to break up countries, and I think this fits in with Israeli policy, to break up Arab countries that the Israelis had always seen as a threat, and that's Saddam. So we have to remember the plan originally was to get seven countries. Iran was supposed to be next. Iraq, Iran, Syria, Yemen, Sudan. And what happened was Iraq was such a up that they couldn't go forward with the plan anymore, and it did help Iran without any question. But I think that this is based, again, on an absolute total ignorance of the forces in the complex tribal and other sectarian forces that exist in the Middle East countries. And they don't seem to care about that. They think there's unbelievable hubris that they could stand up and do whatever they want because first the Soviet Union was gone and that they have unbridled power around the world. And this is the foundation of all of this absolute horror that they've brought to this region are certainly helped in a major way to bring here, and there's no consequences. This is the really terrible thing about that. They just go and make another invasion, another mistake. There's no consequence from the media, from a criminal court, from the United States justice system. They're just being excused by anyone who could hold them to account. And we're going to see more of this.
That's an interesting point, too, because as Joe is pointing out, if you make a, quote, mistake and thousands of people or hundreds of thousands, maybe a million die, a mistake like that, but you can still retire. You don't go to the International Criminal Court.
That's right.
You're not charged with violating international law or U.S. law. You're not charged with torturing people. Matter of fact, you can retire and you can have a presidential library and you can start to go around and make speeches around the country for $150,000 a pop. And eventually, even if you speak out now against Russia, as George W. Bush is, you can become loved even by the Democrats.
Oh, yeah.
So these kind of mistakes, if there's no accountability, quote, mistakes, then no problem. You can even have Donald Trump saying, yeah, my generals will do whatever, and I've given them the ability to defeat ISIS, and guess what they have?
Brian, when I was still at the CIA, I participated in meetings at the CIA, at the State Department, at the White House, in which very senior policymakers were gloating in those first days of the Iraq War that we could be in Tehran by August. Right?
Crazy.
I mean, with completely straight faces. Oh, at this rate, we could be in Tehran by August. And I remember thinking first, but that's a really bad joke. And then realizing, oh my God, they're serious. They're serious about this. You know, I went into a colleague's office one day in CIA headquarters, and he was sitting with a white piece of paper and some Crayola colored markers. And I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm designing the new Iraqi flag. I said, don't you think maybe the Iraqis should be designing the new Iraqi flag? But that's the attitude that you face in the intelligence community and the policy community here in Washington.
That would be funny if it wasn't so disgusting. And you were there, you know. Ali, we're going to give you the last word. We have 60 seconds left.
I mean, what you just said about drawing the Iraqi flag, it shows the arrogance and ignorance of superpowers. Whenever there's one superpower ruling over the world, they create the laws. And that's what, you know, as you've mentioned, that a U.S. president can gloat about the victories that he has done, although we see the massacres and the what he has left behind. And sadly, that's what was happening. Hopefully, we are going into a different world where there will be accountability for by one superpower against the other. When Russia and China hopefully will change that with their influence growing in the world, but. Until then, I guess we still have to live under the influence of one superpower, which the U.S. has shown over the past 2 decades.
Ali Mousaoui, we will have to leave it at that. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We were joined by Ali Mousaoui, a war correspondent covering the war against Daesh in Iraq. And we were also joined from Cairo by Joe Loria, a journalist and political commentator and author of How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. You're listening to Loud and Clear in Washington. We will be right back after this message.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. In this segment, we are joined from Madison by historian and author Alfred McCoy on his new book, In the Shadows of the American Century, The Rise and Decline of U.S. Global Power. Mr. McCoy is the Harrington Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Alfred McCoy, welcome.
Brian, happy to be on the show.
Talk about your new book. When it's In the Shadows of the American Century. It's published by Haymarket Books and I believe also Dispatch Books. What's the basic thesis and when did the American Century start?
The book has two parts. First, it attempts to analyze the character and the key components of U.S. global power that began taking shape during the Spanish-American War of 1898, but really came together in the aftermath of World War II, when the United States emerged as not only the victor nation, but the only one of the major industrial powers that didn't suffer any significant damage. The war was fought, of course, outside the United States, and our casualties, although heavy, were comparatively light. We had about 500,000 casualties. The world suffered 50 to 60 million dead. So we were in relatively good shape. And the whole idea of empire, which had been the basis of Europe's power for the past century, was an idea that was really repudiated by the victory of the war. The defeat of those two ruthless empires, Japan and Germany, really damned the whole idea of imperialism as a just and moral world order. And the United States, as a formerly anti-colonial nation, was well-placed not only by its industrial power and by its military might, but also because of the form of global governance that it advocated. It was well-placed to replace the European powers. And within a decade, the United States had emerged as the world's unchallenged global hegemon, locked in a 40-year struggle with the only really substantial rival power, the Soviet Union. But the Soviet Union had adopted a kind of old-style empire by its conquest and exploitation of Eastern Europe and the Central Asian states as well. And so in that 40-year struggle, again, the American idea of a world of independent sovereign nations, that was the idea whose time had come. And so our victory over the Soviet Union, though difficult and challenging, was more or less preordained.
The last chapter of your book, well, before the acknowledgments chapter, has these words, and I want to read them to you and have you comment. With the ticking of history's clock, time is growing short for the United States to have anything akin to Britain's success in shaping a succeeding world order that protects its interests, preserves its prosperity, and bears the imprint of its best values. Now that the American century is ending, we can only wonder what kind of shadow it will cast across the globe for future generations. Now, of course, the British Empire basically came to an end or was eclipsed with the ascension of the U.S. Empire, as you're saying, following World War II. And Britain was more or less assigned a position within the new world order after World War II of being fundamentally a junior partner of the new global power, the U.S. power. There's no other rival power, certainly within the capitalist world at the moment, that will take the place of the United States should its empire be eclipsed. So you're not actually predicting a soft landing here.
I think it's going to be more abrupt than we imagine. Look, this is one thing that people don't appreciate or understand about empires. At the peak of their power, they seem like one of those, sandal movies about ancient Rome. You know, incredibly awesome in their military might, their grand capitals, their cultural dominion, all the rest. They seem indomitable. And yet empires, by their very nature, because they operate far beyond their natural boundaries, are incredibly fragile. And so, like many fragile ecosystems, once the change, the decline sets in, you get an unpredictable cascade effect, and they collapse with an extraordinary and holy speed. I mean, European imperialism spread like a force of nature around the globe for 500 years, and the seven overseas European empires ruled over basically half of humanity for a full century. And in little more than a decade after World War II, they were all gone. The Soviet Empire, which ruled over Eastern Europe and was a rival of the United States, took 2 years to go. The British Empire took 20 years to unravel. The French were gone in two or three years when they finally decided to give it up. So once empires start unraveling, it happens very quickly. And if you just look at the New York Times, every single day, there's an article. Last Friday, it was, Burma's moving to Beijing over the Rohingya issue. And, that whole effort that President Obama had of courting Burma and bringing it into the world community, that's over. Moscow is getting air bases inside Egypt. Egypt is making a historic shift back to Moscow. Again, since the Carter administration, we've had Egypt on our side. On Monday, it was Australia debating a shift to China and a huge debate saying that basically American power is over in Asia and Australia has to make a sensible strategic shift. And then there's another article about Canada going it alone in world trade, trying to pick up the U.S. mantle as the leader of global trade. And what we're seeing is it's sort of like a game of chess. You start out, and you can know you can beat this guy because you're a really great chess player, and you lose a couple of pawns, who cares? And then you lose a rook, and then you take your bishop, and before you know it, in a way that you completely didn't anticipate, bang, checkmate, you've lost, it's over. Time to put down your king and call it a day. Well, that seems to be what's happening right now. And there's two factors. One, long term. By 1960, the United States' share of the global economy had dropped from about 50% right after World War II, when we were the last industrial power standing. We were down to about 40%. Today, we're down around about 20%, and there are economists that argue if you take a more reliable index of what money is worth, purchasing power, actually the United States, they argue, only has 15% of world trade. So there's that slow, inexorable decline. And along with that decline in kind of gross economic throw weight. We're losing our technological edge. We're losing our percentage of world trade. But there's the other thing that's happened in the last 3 or 4 years that's really deciding is that China has taken its $4 trillion in hard currency that earned primarily since 2002 by trading with the United States when it joined the World Trade Organization. And it's using that $4 trillion to realize the vision of turning Asia, Africa, and Europe, you know, those seemingly three separate continents, into a unified landmass through its One Belt, One Road strategy, laying down an infrastructure of oil pipelines, rails, and roads, and gas pipelines that unifies the vast 6,000-mile breadth of the Eurasian landmass into a unified economic producer. And with all that infrastructure and all those lines of power tending towards Beijing, and as that happens, and it's happening very quickly, if you will, as if almost by natural law, then power will follow that infrastructure away from Washington and towards Beijing. And that's the and there are all kinds of, you know, ephemeral events that are marking this. So, for example, events in the South China Sea with China building 7 military bases. The rise of Chinese power in the Indian Ocean and the Arabian Sea. But that, those are, if you will, the epiphenomena that are produced by this more fundamental structural change. And very few people in the United States are aware of the nature of this geopolitical change. Very few Americans understand the way that U.S. global power for 70 years has rested on dominion over that same Eurasian landmass that China is now capturing. But there's a British historian at Oxford University named John Darwin, who is very distinguished in studying the history of imperial clashes, the wars of empires for the past past 1,000 years across the breadth of Eurasia. And John Darwin wrote in one of his magisterial works surveying this 1,000 years of imperial rivalry that he said that at the end of World War II, the United States emerged as the most powerful and prosperous empire in the history of the world because it controlled the axial ends of the Eurasian landmass. Now, what might Professor Darwin mean by that? Well, he didn't tell us. And in my book, I tried to figure out what he was talking about. And it's this. At the end of World War II, we dominated this vast world island, these three continents, by establishing one point of axial control at the west through the NATO alliance. And then at the eastern end, the eastern axial end of the Eurasian landmass, we signed 4 bilateral military treaties in 1951 with Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and Australia. And this gave us a string of military bases along the Pacific littoral. And between these two axial bastions, we laid down these circles of steel, one on top of the other. First, mutual defense pacts like NATO, like CETA, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, like ANZUS, the Australian-New Zealand-U.S. Security Pact. And then on top of that, hundreds of military bases, 700 bases by the end of the close of the war, filled with nearly 1,700 jet fighters and strategic bombers, not to mention 1,000 intercontinental ballistic missiles all pointed at that Eurasian landmass. And then we had these massive fleets, the 5th Fleet of the U.S. Navy in the Mediterranean, in the Persian Gulf, the 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean, and the 7th Fleet in the Western Pacific and the Indian Ocean. And it was this dominion over the Eurasian landmass that was the geopolitical foundation of U.S. global power for 70 years. And that's starting to crumble. President Obama had a very clever strategy for rebuilding and maintaining that structure, and President Trump has systematically undone Obama's strategy. And we can talk about that if you want.
Sure. You're listening to Alfred McCoy. Alfred McCoy is the Harrington Professor of History in Madison at the University of Wisconsin. We're talking about his latest book, In the Shadows of the American Century. He has many other books, including The Politics of Heroin, Torture and Impunity, Questions of Torture, Policing America's Empire, and more. Professor, McCoy, if we had had this discussion 40 years ago, we were both younger then, but I remember vividly having discussions with young anti-war activists at that time and young academics at that time who said, look, the U.S. just lost in Vietnam, it lost in Cambodia, it lost in Laos. Portugal, a U.S. ally, had a revolution in 1974. Mozambique, Angola, Guinea-Bissau became free. There was revolutions brewing in Nicaragua, later in El Salvador. The Iranian Revolution happened a year or two later in 1979. Afghan went into the socialist camp in 1978 through a coup d'etat. It looked as if there was a huge contraction or maybe the end of the U.S. empire then. And yet the U.S. during the 1980s had this huge, surprising comeback. And then ultimately, and surprisingly, shockingly, the Soviet Union was the entity that collapsed. And then there was the apparent desire by U.S. policymakers to enshrine the unipolar domination of the world. This time, the forces at work, the forces that are leading to the limitation or the contraction of the U.S. empire, you believe are, in essence, irreversible. I think that's what you're saying. And I'd like to, one, ask you if that's true, if that's your view. And secondly, to go through, in addition to what we've just talked about in terms of economic domination over the Eurasian landmass, some of the sort of phenomena that are accentuating this process and how you believe this will play out over, say, the next few decades. Go ahead.
Back in the 1970s, when everybody was looking at those events, and I was just like you were, there was, if you will, very little understanding of the essential underpinnings of U.S. global power. Look, the United States is not only the most powerful empire in the history of the world, but it's also the world's least studied. Throughout the Cold War, the Soviet Union damned America as an imperial power. So American historians, not wanting to be unpatriotic, came up with the doctrine of American exceptionalism. You know, we were a world power or maybe even a hegemon, but we weren't an empire. And therefore, we didn't study the apparatus, the rock rib fundamentals of U.S. global power like we would have for any other world empire. And so America's hegemony made us not only the world's greatest power, but also its least studied. So one of the things I try and do in the book is, you know, repair this, if you will, this intellectual oversight, and do a quick survey of the fundamentals of U.S. global power. I've just talked about the geopolitical underpinnings of U.S. power, which is something that, despite the sort of might and mass of the U.S. military, you know, Eisenhower understood it when he built it back in the 1950s. But Americans have been on top of the world for so long, we've collectively forgotten how we got there. We no longer realize the design of our global power. And apart from those geopolitical underpinnings I just described, yeah, America's imperial apparatus was kind of a four-tier structure. One, a military of unprecedented power that I just described, all those bases, bombers, and naval flotillas. That's one part. Second, a global economic apparatus, not only dynamic multinational corporations that functioned very effectively and profitably behind the shield of all that massive power, but we built an apparatus during World War II under the General Agreement of Trades and Tariffs, realizing, if you will, and institutionalizing the British idea of free trade. And we also were a leader in establishing trade pacts. The General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs became the World Trade Organization. The United States began signing all kinds of multilateral and bilateral trade pacts to maximize its access to markets and materials around the globe, and to build a world order of basically free and open trade, in theory of comparative economic advantage for all players. And then there was the diplomacy. The United States maintained a very active diplomacy. We had agile diplomats who were real force multipliers, and we had, along with those diplomats, soft power, the extraordinary influence of Hollywood, of basketball, of the Rotary, all these American global institutions, our missionary efforts. There's these evangelical missionaries and the mainstream denominations are a kind of low-profile American presence in many remote quarters around the globe. But most importantly, I suppose most distinctly in this apparatus. Well, the thing that really distinguished the character of the American Empire from, let's say, the British before us was the covert dimension, because there was a contradiction that lay at the heart of the U.S. global position. One, we presided over the idea of a world divided into sovereign nations. Every people had their own sovereign state. Imperialism, dominion was over. It was repudiated by the Four Freedoms, enunciated by President Roosevelt at the start of World War II. And the United States fitfully, you know, with some contradictions, worked for the end of European empire after World War II. So we created the UN, and we had the idea that the 190-plus institutions of the UN, from the smallest Pacific nation to the biggest continental power, all have equal votes in the General Assembly. So this idea of a community of nations ruled by law, that was the American ideal. So how do you exercise asymmetric power? If you're one power in an equal community of nations, how do you dominate? How do you control? Well, the way the United States resolved, if you will, the central contradiction of the age between a community of equal nations and the rise of history's most powerful hegemonic power is covertly. So the United States, during the long years of the Cold War, developed the NSA as a very powerful surveillance apparatus, giving us better information about the world, about the inner workings of every government around the planet than they had about us. Moreover, the CIA became expert in manipulating, determining that the people that filled the new presidential palaces in the 100 new emerging nations around the globe that came out of those seven European empires, that these presidents and prime ministers would be pro-American. And we were masters at manipulating elections through covert operations. And when electoral manipulations failed, the CIA would work through our friendly military and promote coups to push, for example, Salvador Allende, elected in Chile as a democratic socialist, push him out of power and replace him with General Pinochet. And we did this quite regularly around the globe. After 1958, there was about a 15-year period when about a quarter of the sovereign nations around the globe changed governments via military coup. And the United States was behind most of that. And so, you know, we've now begun losing our edge in every single one of those four arenas. And in the covert arena, the shift is quite dramatic. During the Cold War and the two decades of U.S. as the sole superpower after that, you know, we had, through the NSA, you know, access to the most private and intimate information around the globe for what world leaders were up to. And we used that information to manipulate elections and to pressure prime ministers and presidents around the world to do our bidding. And we were quite effective about it. So a superpower, you know, has an advantage of information and manipulates other nations. Well, in the 2016 presidential elections, the tables were turned. Russia, and we'll learn the full extent of this when Bobby Mueller, if he gets a chance, presents his report. Russia apparently manipulated our elections through their sophisticated cyber operations.
Although there's no conclusive evidence that's been presented about that yet. We'll see. We'll see. But so far, none.
There's no question they manipulated, right? Okay. I mean, that we know. Okay. How important it was, that's another question. But they did certainly manipulate, and they did have an impact. And very simply, let's put this, you know, in the last Russian elections, we didn't manipulate, okay? Those democratic forces that we promoted, you know, not only lost, but in the aftermath of the election, they got crushed. But a pro-Russian candidate emerged in the United States, Russia backed him. Whatever the degree of the support, the outcome is pretty clear. So let me just put it simply. A global superpower manipulates. A defeating superpower gets manipulated. And that's where we seem to be. We're losing our edge in that covert dimension.
In the covert dimension is one phase of it. As you said in the beginning or earlier, at the end of World War II, the rest of the world lay in smoldering ruins, basically. And the U.S., with 6% of the world's population, had maybe 50% of the world's production. In terms of the economic rise of China, China is presenting as a priority in its policy, and it seems, unlike the U.S. policy at the moment, which it seems to me at least to be very ad hoc, if it exists, that the Chinese have a particular policy. They call it win-win. They're trying to have a peaceful rise. They're using and leveraging economic power and the power of a very ascendant and dynamically growing economy to compete with the United States all over the Eurasian map in Africa. Their main concern seems to be to avoid a war. Part of your, because that would be the thing that would stop China's rise. And of course, even though China's maybe the second largest economy at this point in aggregate terms, it's certainly no match for the United States in many particular areas. You talk in your book in the third area about the possibilities of war or the possibilities of World War III. You look at it, what's the present situation? You look at it decades later. How do you view that? Of course, World War I, World War II shaped, ended the old European empires, gave rise to a new world empire, the United States. What's your view on the war peace issue?
One of the scenarios in my book is titled World War III with China. Look, the most influential of all the think tanks, in many ways, the sort of national security think tank is the RAND Corporation, established by the U.S. Air Force at the end of World War II. And last year, the RAND Corporation issued a report called War with China. And RAND is famous for their very sophisticated and very contrarian strategic analysis. They issue their report to the Pentagon, but they're not controlled by the Pentagon. They're designed to be critical and independent, and indeed they often are. And they're realpolitik. There's not a bleeding heart in the entire RAND Corporation. And so they just look at the world as it is. And the RAND Corporation assessed war with China, and they looked at the broad array of economic advantage of military forces, and they concluded that, you know what, the United States might not win right now if we had a war with China. The Pentagon did a report last year probing the same question, and they came to, in their strategic analysis, the Pentagon came to the same conclusion. You know, in a war with China right now, we might not win. Well, at the present, the United States and China are bound together very tightly economically. There are tensions in the relationship, tensions, for example, over the South China Sea. China's built 7 military bases. China lays claim to the South China Sea in defiance of the UN law of the sea. That China's laying claim to this is basically under what they call the 9-dash line. But basically, the whole South China Sea is their sovereign territory. It's not international waters. This is a major long-term problem. But right now, the immediate possibility of a war with China seems remote. But in a few years, when China's economic edge increases, when its military grows ever stronger, which it is very seriously, very systematically, and when China's technological advantage grows, because they now have the world's fastest supercomputers, they're getting some very important innovations. China is, like many rising powers, not able to challenge the United States right across the board. They have nothing like our carrier battle fleet so far. They just have two rather small or medium-sized jump aircraft carriers with the kind of bent bows that allow aircraft to sort of take a leap off. You know, they're learning fast. So they can't challenge us across the board. But what they're doing is, like many rising powers, they're working out where are the weaknesses in the global might of the U.S. military. And China seems to be focusing on space warfare, particularly satellites, and cyber warfare, and hence their rising superiority in supercomputing, which has been going on for about 7 years now and is building apace, and their advantages in certain aspects of satellite technology. They're getting an edge. For example, China announced that they're developing what's called photon communications between ground stations and their satellites. These are using basically beams of light transmitted from unique devices that are impervious to hacking. U.S. satellites use basically microwave communications, which can be penetrated and hacked. And you might say, okay, so we lose our satellites, so what? Look, the United States, that's one aspect of American imperial power, American hegemony that nobody has understood. Okay, it's not only did we have that four-tier apparatus that I laid out in these massive fleets, the 6th, the 5th, and the 7th fleet, 1,700 bombers, 1,000 ballistic missiles, etc. But we had the world's only operating system of global telecommunication satellites. We launched it in 1967, and for the next 40 years, we built on it and perfected it. Well, in just 3 years, China is going to have the world's second system of comprehensive global telecommunication satellites. And this is a fundamental challenge. Now, look, satellites are used by the U.S. military for the three C's, command, control, and communication. U.S. ships know where they are in the ocean because they sail by GPS. Okay, so if China can hack or compromise our satellites, they can blind the U.S. military and ground our fighters and basically cripple our ships and blind our military and gain an instantaneous strategic advantage.
We're gonna leave it there because we are completely out of time. It's been a great honor to talk with Alfred McCoy. He is the Harrington Professor of History in Madison at the University of Wisconsin. His latest book is In the Shadows of the American Century. You're listening to Loud and Clear after a very short break. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.